If you've been told to pull up your socks, then make sure it's a pair of TNT socks. The TNT shop is now open at TNTRadio.live. This is the Chris Smith Show on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
G'day, g'day. Welcome to the program. It is good to have your company. And it, of course, is the 26th day of March. We're not far away from Easter. And for most people, that means an Easter break. We're all looking forward to that. We're now starting to get Easter eggs into the home. That's a good sign, a very good sign. Not for the waistline, but a good sign that Easter is nigh. I'm broadcasting from Sydney, Australia. And for the record, it is a very sunny day in Sydney. A summer wave, I guess, in this season of autumn, which is greatly appreciated. A very hot day indeed. In this edition, a whistleblower exposes a government conspiracy aimed at punishing the victims of COVID vaccines who are simply seeking compensation. This is a red-hot story, and although the Senate has been told about this week, well, guess what? Not a peep from mainstream media, despite this being the ultimate bastard act against those who, of course, are still suffering because of vaccine COVID jabs. They're now being outed because they dared to ask for compensation. We have a compensation scheme in Australia which works fine. You supply the medical evidence, you supply your expenses, and you are compensated. But wait till you hear what Senator Rennick has to say about how this system is going, thanks to that whistleblower. We'll talk about that first off on the program. Well, the controversial and fearless New South Wales MP Mark Latham will join us shortly. He has got plenty to get across today, from the UN resolution, partly supported, as you have heard in our news, by the US against Israel, and Australia's unstoppable immigration juggernaut, to changes for minimum wage earners and more evidence of the impracticality of climate change targets. Plenty to talk about, Mark Latham, coming up in the first hour of our program. We'll get down to the state of Victoria in the show as well. The federal MP for the seat of Monash, Russell Broadbent, will be with us. He will discuss belated changes to vaccine mandates. But the Socialist Republic of Victoria, of course, don't want a bar of it. You see, you've got to live in a normalised state of fear if you live in Victoria. Whether it's lockdowns or whether it's vaccine mandates, we will not be changing them in the Socialist Republic. Just extraordinary. We'll talk to our good friend Russell Broadbent about that. Plus, he's got some data too from a comprehensive study and a survey of Australians on the prospect of a cashless society. We know that the big banks are driving this hard, but maybe the big banks would like to look at the survey closely and learn a very important lesson. My special guest later in the show will be forensic social worker Matilda Borden. We must discuss this standoff between Minister Bill Shorten and the states. You may have caught up with the story today. There are changes now for the National Disability Insurance Scheme, and the premiers of states and territories are all saying, well, we'll be paying more. A little birdie has tipped them off, and Bill Shorten has not denied it. So there's a little bit of a standoff between the feds and the states and territories, all of whom, apart from one, are Labor. But we'll also talk about state care and seeking justice for those who were poorly treated. We've had a terrible history when it comes to state care in Australia, and maybe it's about time we got it right. And don't forget our talkback numbers. If you'd like to have your say, step right up. We don't bite. Well, not often. We don't bite often. And there's no ceiling on opinion either, so I'd love to hear from you on our talkback lines. You can call from the United States or Canada on 1-888-201-6425. From the UK, 033-0024-1026. And from Australia or New Zealand, 1-800-670-310. You're with Chris Smith. This is TNT.
Russia, gas prices, COVID mandates.
It just doesn't seem like anybody's doing anything about it.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Well, don't rely on mainstream media to follow the news and issues that really matter. Don't rely on them again, especially if the news in question might have something to do with COVID vaccine injuries. You see, this has become the media's deliberate blind spot. will just ignore that. They won't report on anything that might impact negatively on those sacrosanct experimental COVID vaccines. No. That's their blind spot. They won't dare upset the government. They won't dare upset medical authorities who fought so hard to get those jabs in our arms. Take this latest revelation from the LNP Senator Jared Rennick. He has told the Senate that the Therapeutic Goods Administration, who played a significant role in getting us those jabs, they are overriding the decisions of specialists, medical specialists, in refusing claims for vaccine injury from people who received COVID-19 vaccinations. They are somehow becoming a star chamber over very simple compensation claims. So despite expert medical opinion, the TGA, the public servants basically, won't have a bar of these compensation claims. Now, I'm sorry, I don't give a stuff what kind of journalist you think you are or how important you might be in the tree. This is a red-hot conspiracy to hide the embarrassing truth about vaccine injuries, and if it's not a story, I'm not here. Now, Services Australia administers this scheme, which offers people a way to seek a one-off compensation payment if they experienced harm from a vaccination. They don't have to go through lengthy or expensive courtroom fights. So it's a very good scheme, and it came into being very soon after the pandemic began. According to the Epoch Times today, it covers lost earnings, out-of-pocket expenses, paid attendant care services, and deceased vaccine recipient payments, and also funeral costs. So these are all costs that many people can't afford. There's a scheme there for them to apply to. They've got to have their receipts, and they've got to have that expert specialist medical opinion. So to meet the criteria for the payment, you must have your condition verified by a medical specialist in the relevant field of practice. For instance, if you've got a problem with myocarditis, you've got to have a cardiologist signing off on the fact that that's exactly what you have. And then a medical report and evidence of the expenses being claimed for assessment are produced. But a whistleblower has now come forward to blow the system right out of the water.
And I've got an insider from the TGA, and I can't say his name. He's left it now because he doesn't want to lose his job if he goes public, who played a big role in designing this scheme. And the whole point of that scheme was once the injured person got a specialist to say that the person was injured by the vaccine, he or she would be entitled to compensation. Now, that is not happening. What is happening is Services Australia make these people who, on average, have to wait 297 days to get a decision. These people can no longer work, or many of them can no longer work. They are seriously ill. They have to do all the legwork of trying to book in and see a specialist, a cardiologist, a rheumatologist, whatever, and that takes a lot of work. It's very expensive. You've got to go and get MRIs or something to back up your claim. And then they're basically being neglected. Now, what's happening, though, is Services Australia make these people jump that hurdle, and what they do is then they refer it back to the TGA. And the TGA doctors are turning around and saying, we are overriding the decision of the specialists who actually examined the patient.
They're overriding what specialists are telling them. This is the TGA. So not only are these victims of the vaccines almost waiting 300 days for approval, which is appalling, despite being armed with the very best medical diagnosis, once their claim is belatedly approved, in comes the TGA, a group of lesser qualified public servants, to deny their claim. It's a complete and utter outrage. And think about it if you have been adversely impacted by the vaccine and are seeking a small amount of compensation. Now, as the whistleblower told Senator Rennick, the doctors at the TGA are not qualified to be overriding specialists, especially when they haven't even examined the patient in question. The specialist saw the patient, not someone out of the TGA, and yet they're overriding what someone else has done. Senator Rennick is saying that there are 1,000 reports of suspected deaths due to the vaccines in Australia, and yet the TGA has recognised only 14. Rennick told the Senate that when he presses the TGA and asks them, can you actually prove this wasn't a vaccine? They say, no, we can't. So they can't prove that a vaccine did not play a role in their myocarditis, for instance, but they put a big red cross through the claim anyway. What is going on here is a shocking cover-up, but because it's not politically correct in the mainstream media to do the hard work, join the dots and present the story publicly, the TGA thinks it can get away with the cover-up and the distortion of this data, and that's what they're doing. They're not being put under the microscope or under any scrutiny whatsoever, especially from no one in the Canberra gallery who would laugh at something like this. Who cares about victims of vaccines? And none of this takes into consideration the impact COVID vaccines are having on the 10,000 unexplained excess deaths in Australia either, which occurred between May and December 2021, just 10,000 in that period, and that is when the vaccines were rolled out. At the very least, a responsible federal government should be conducting a thorough medical investigation into whether there's a link and how many deaths can be attributed to the mRNA vaccines. Oh, no, we can't possibly tell the truth. We couldn't possibly have an inquiry. Any of the key medical agencies should hold such an inquiry. Any, except, of course, for the TGA, which right now deserves an inquiry into their own practices. This is TNT.
TNT's James Freeman.
Now that I'm sitting on the other side of the fence, I see the budget in a very different light. I find the discussions and leaks in the press in the weeks running up to the budget totally patronising. You know, will he, won't he, give us some tax cuts? When the reality is that nothing in the budget will make any material difference to anyone, pretty much. That's usually the story. It is a game of musical chairs where the government giveth with one hand and taketh with the other. And we're all reminded about how little money that we've got left in our pockets.
James Freeman on today's News Talk TNT.
Affordable housing, we can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. Our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification, 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are Opportunity Zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702 or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that.
Plug in.
Website
TNTradio.live.
Check it out.
Today's News Talk Radio.
It's the coolest.
TNT.
Hey, good to have you company. There's plenty to come, so do not go anywhere. Let's get to Mark Latham, MLC, which stands for a member of the Legislative Council, for those listening elsewhere. He's an independent MP in the New South Wales Parliament. Mark Latham, welcome to TNT.
Thanks, Chris. Always good to be here.
Thank you, mate. I want to start with the minimum wage. The federal government is apparently pushing for some kind of minimum and award wage increase that keeps pace with inflation. The Fair Work Commission assesses this each year. I've got to make the point before we discuss it that their recent decisions about the minimum wage was in no way in keeping with what the inflation rate was at the time. And usually that seems to be the overriding factor. Do we need to peg this to a guaranteed minimum? Do we need to do any more than what the system already does?
Well, I don't think it needs an automatic CPI increase. It depends on economic conditions, really, what happens with the minimum wage. One thing you can say about a minimum wage increase is the people who receive it spend it. So if you're looking for economic stimulus to try and boost the economy, an increase in the minimum wage in real terms is an effective way of doing that. The ACTU is arguing for 5%. The government wants to keep pace with inflation. That sounds like about 4%. Mm. And the employer groups are arguing for 2%. Maybe somewhere in between is the best outcome by the commission. So we'll have to see what happens. The economy does need a boost. You know, GDP growth is sluggish, but we've also got to be mindful of the fact it's sluggish because the Reserve Bank put up interest rates too substantially, and we've got to keep inflation under control to make sure that doesn't happen again. So I would have thought 3% is probably a fair outcome in the circumstances. You know, there is an equity factor. Those on the minimum wage are doing the worst jobs in the economy almost by definition. And in a cost of living crisis, they're doing it toughest in that regard.
It's interesting that you said in that answer that if you give the money to these minimum wage earners, they will spend it. Is that the way it usually works? Because minimum wage earners are struggling to pay off the basics, pay their utility bills, et cetera, et cetera. Don't they put that money towards that? Or you're telling me that the evidence is that they spend their money in the open market in buying products?
Well, they don't save any. They've got to eat, so they spend it in supermarkets.
Right.
They've got some basic retail needs and they pay their bills. The point is that their marginal propensity to consume is almost 100%,
yeah,
and their marginal rate of savings is zero. So that's the point. If you have a wage increase for people on, you know, $300,000-$400,000 a year, they save a fair part of it. Those on the minimum wage don't save any of it. They spend it all.
Yeah. Okay. I want to talk about climate change, one of our favourite topics, of course. And isn't it funny, Mark, how many times that you hear climate change policies or announcements or targets or aims fall on their face because, you know, it's such an evangelistic thing to do to announce what we're doing about saving the planet. This is what we're going to do about EVs. This is what we'll do about windmills and solar farms, et cetera, et cetera. And it all sounds fabulous, except when it comes time to actually get the work done, talk to the various stakeholders, understand that this doesn't kind of work in practice. The market won't operate the way the government is trying to make it work. And this is certainly happening when it comes to emissions regulations. He trumpeted them very loudly, the climate change minister, Chris Bowen, but he's retreating big time on this evangelical car emissions regulations. I get the feeling the more I see this bloke, the more I realise, well, I knew from the start, but the more other people must realise, he is totally and utterly out of his depth.
Yeah, Chris Bowen has a long history of getting things wrong as a federal government minister. We saw that with border protection under the Rudd and Gillard governments when he was the immigration minister and 50,000 people came in and a large number of them drowned. Mm. At sea between Australia and Indonesia. He was also the author earlier in that time of Retail Watch and Petrol Watch, which were failed, hopeless schemes. And now he's running climate and energy policy out of Canberra. But, you know, no matter what Bowen does, and he doesn't have a track record of anything successful in public administration, it's very hard for governments to overcome ingrained consumer habits. In Australia, the truth is we have the highest rate of rooftop solar take-up in the world. Australians seem to like that. But the lowest rate of electric vehicle purchasing. So what are you going to do about that in a big country where people drive long distances and don't want the massive inconvenience of constantly having to charge their car up just because you want to go on a family holiday down the coast or up the coast? So, you know, these are ingrained consumer habits, and there's no way in the world Australia's going to save the global climate with EV policies out of Canberra. In fact, there's nothing Australia can do with our low amount of global emissions to change the climate anyway. So all of this is futile, but the most futile of the lot is trying to make Australians buy electric vehicles that they just don't want to drive.
And the biggest seller at the moment seem to be these really big utes at the moment, you know, the twin cab ute. They're not only being purchased by tradies, they're being purchased by families who would normally get an SUV because they can carry so much, they can certainly have that utility value. And they're the ones that are going to be hit most by these reductions. It sort of flies in the face of what the market is crying out for.
Yeah, not only are Australians averse to buying electric vehicles, they just don't want them and don't want the inconvenience of all the charging requirements that are needed. The consumer patterns over the last couple of years have gone in the opposite direction. Australians are buying bigger cars, SUVs, the utes that you've mentioned, people moving type cars. The motoring consumer has moved away from the smaller vehicle. So what's the federal government going to do about that? I mean, these emission control mechanisms are like a car tax flying against the consumer pattern. The motorists want to move in a different direction to what Chris Bowen wants in his climate change crazy world.
To answer me this question, I may be in need of doing a little bit more due diligence on this area of EVs, but if my EV broke down, say, between, I don't know, Newcastle and Queensland, and I was on an inner road, nowhere near major cities or big towns, and my EV broke down, say, 2 hours away from the nearest town, I know what to do if I run out of petrol. I hail the first car, I go to the petrol station 2 hours away, I try and get some petrol in a can, I pay for it, I come back, I hitch a ride, I fill it up, I keep going. What do you do when your battery stops in the middle of that same area?
Well, you're basically stuck. You'll have to walk or hitch that ride that you mentioned to try and get to some town or settlement. But you've got massive problems in the adjustment. You see, government has set all these targets. New South Wales government 3 years ago under Matt Keane said, I will spend a huge amount of money. We want 50% of the cars out there to be EVs. How many first responders have they trained in what you do when an EV fire or accident is problematic? Mechanics, 50,000 motor repair people registered in New South Wales, how many of those have got training in the safe way of repairing an EV vehicle? Basically none. 3 years later, basically none. I'm on a committee inquiry here that shows there's been no training. How many modules and courses does TAFE offer in New South Wales? Basically none. So all of that is a huge problem. How do you get these cars fixed? Not many motor repair dealers know how to fix them.
No.
So it's a huge problem, Chris, in the safety. And on top of that, we've got to recognise a large number of these cars come from China, where we heard evidence earlier today at the committee inquiry that if it's a cobalt lithium battery, this is where the fires come from. And we're seeing that increasingly with the e-scooters and the e-bikes, where if these things catch on fire in an apartment block, we're courting disaster, a large number of injuries and fatalities. So the whole electric vehicle and electric bike push has got problems on every single front. The consumers don't want it, and there's a whole bunch of safety issues that aren't being addressed by government and industry.
And what are you reading about what may happen with these planned offshore wind farms, both south of Sydney and north of Sydney, up in Port Stephens? There have been protests in both locations. The locals don't want them, and they've got a whole raft of reasons as to why it'll denigrate the environment, it'll denigrate the ocean tourism, ecotourism, etc., and fishing, which of course play a large role in those areas. What are you reading about this? Is the government going to have to do what they're doing on these car emission regulations and backtrack once again, because they're going to lose seats if they start ramming this down people's throats?
Well, that's right. Locals don't want them because they also degrade the property values because they're very ugly out there, spoiling the ocean views and the landscape, the seascape. So that's a huge problem. But will it happen? Just because government wants it doesn't mean that it's economic. I mean, if you owned a wind or solar farm, it's a lot cheaper to operate them in the windy districts of Western New South Wales than the extra cost of putting them out on those big platforms offshore, especially when in the western part of New South Wales, government and taxpayers are paying to hook you into the transmission system. So I'm not too sure that the Chris Bowen, New South Wales, Victorian government vision of this will be realised. In fact, there was a very important decision in Victoria where on environmental grounds, the offshore wind farm couldn't go ahead. So I hope there's more of that. You know, it's sort of worlds collide for the lefties. Do they put the marine environment first, or their delusion in thinking they can save the planet? So I don't. These things are dangerous, sure, and they worry people, but I'm not too sure it's going to happen on a large scale.
And the greenies, where are the greenies? Like, if you are putting construction platforms, infrastructure in, you know, the oceans off, you know, offshore, it's got to have an impact on fishing schools, and you've got to have an impact on migration of whales. But we haven't seen the greenies complain at all about wind turbines, because that's the religion.
That is the religion, and there are conflicts here. You know, one of the funniest things I see in the New South Wales upper house is the Green Party members complaining about the construction of synthetic hockey and soccer fields in Sydney. They say, oh, these have got a heating effect, that if you get rid of grass and you put in an artificial surface, which makes for a better soccer and hockey game, particularly at a junior level. Meanwhile, they are wallpapering large parts of country New South Wales with vast amounts of solar panels. What's the heating impact there? And also these ugly wind farms. So, no, the religion of climate change overwhelms all considerations, and apparently a synthetic hockey field in Liverpool is a much bigger problem than hundreds of square kilometres of solar panels being built all over the state.
It's so thick, isn't it? Because this is an infinitesimal, less than an infinitesimal impact on whatever they want to call it, global warming or the warming of the surface of the planet. Like, seriously, it is just a joke. It is just stupid. It's starting to get ludicrous. And, you know, they'll quickly tell the kids they can't play football on their soccer field when it rains, but when they've got a synthetic course, they can get out there and play. They'd love to do that. How about thinking about the kids for once?
Yeah, look, the lack of perspective on this is just amazing. It sort of borders on lunacy. But as you say, if people sign up to a secular religion, and that's what climate change action is, they lose all perspective on what's real and what's not. And the fact that they're now complaining about synthetics, soccer and hockey fields in suburban areas and schools is just plain nuts.
Yeah, it is nuts, mate. Absolute nuts. I want to take a quick 30-second break for some news. We'll get an update right now and come back with you, Mark. Mark Latham in a second on TNT.
I have some good news.
TNT Radio News.
Matt Boylan here with your TNT headlines. Russian President Vladimir Putin says Friday's terrorist attack in Moscow was carried out by radical Islamists, but he says he's more interested in finding out who gave them the order. The divide between the US and Israel's deepening after Washington refused to block a UN Security Council resolution calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. And farmers have rolled up to London in their tractors protesting against ludicrous climate policies, which they say are hurting their bottom lines.
Why not give TNT Radio a follow? We're on all major social platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Gab, and Getter. Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time right here on today's News Talk.
TNT Radio.
TNT Radio.
Mark Latham, MLC, Independent MP in the New South Wales Parliament, is my guest at the moment. All right, let's talk about immigration. Albo's big, unaffordable Australia policy. It looks to be rather unstoppable, Mark, because we've now got immigration experts being quoted in newspapers today saying promises about cutting the number by the middle of the year, which is apparently what they told us late last year. They're saying the way visas are being dished out and other issues, it won't happen. They won't be cutting immigration as they're promising. They're going to suffer at the ballot box over this because the public is right on to big Australia here. It's impacting in their suburbs.
Well, it's in the suburbs of working class people. You won't see it in Albanese's electorate, inner Sydney, or, of course, the lower North Shore or the wealthier parts of Australia. Yep. Newly arrived migrants, by and large, move to working class areas where they've got some of their ethnic population already in place. So the distribution is uneven. But if you're worried about housing affordability in those working class areas, the worst thing you can do is make the situation worse by bringing in migrants who basically have got nowhere to live and ramp up the rental costs and add to the heat in the housing market if they are able to afford to live and ramp up the rental costs and add to the heat in the housing market if they are able to afford a new home purchase. So, and Chris, the numbers post-COVID are just astronomical. Like, Australia got used to the idea of about 150,000 migrants a year coming in. Post-COVID, they've gone up to 500,000, and the government's promises to get them below 300,000. Well, they're still very, very big numbers by historical standards. And in the middle of a housing affordability crisis where you're worried about rents, you're worried about the cost of housing in the major cities. Well, the newly arrived migrants don't move to Bathurst and Orange and country areas. They live in the major cities where the housing affordability issues are at their worst. So this is the very worst time in that regard for Big Australia policies. But boy, you give the Big Australia advocates half an opportunity to ramp up the immigration numbers, and that's what they do.
It's just mad. Where do these people go to live? Because I think the vacancy rate at the moment is between 1.4 and 1.7%. There's simply not enough dwellings for people to take up. You know, you go to my son went to a place recently and there was 150 people in one line to go to a townhouse to get themselves accommodation, rental accommodation. Now, you've got to add to that line scores of other people who are now coming in 2024. Where do they live? Where do they go and stay?
Well, you know, your old stomping ground, Chris, of Fairfield in Western Sydney is the most popular destination for newly arrived migrants, also refugees, and very often it's crowding into the back room of flats and apartments where they've got family or friends who can accommodate them on a temporary basis, but temporary becomes longer term. If the housing stock is not increasing at the same pace as immigration, obviously you've got a housing crisis, you've got a rental and affordability crisis, and that's what this government policy has inflicted upon us. Now, sure, during COVID, immigration was basically zero. Well, there was a lesson in that. Come back at a moderate rate so you don't make the housing affordability problem worse.
Yeah.
The housing stock's not increasing, and they're not bringing in the tradies to build the new housing anyway. So it's all out of whack. It's all uneven. And the Big Australia advocates have a lot to answer for.
It was almost as if in 2023 they were so enamoured by what was going on with the voice referendum that they forgot about everything else. They forgot about cost of living. We'll deal with that in 2024. And as for immigration, just open the gates. We'll be right. It'll sort itself out. It's such willy-nilly policy decision-making. And, of course, they were too focused on something that wasn't as important as those other two issues.
Well, probably everyone was focused on the voice instead of attending to this basic issue of immigration numbers. And it's only now we're getting very strong media and public focus on just how big Australia has become. And it's unsustainable. You talk about the impact on the environment. Urban sprawl is environmentally damaging. So all these things are unsustainable. You don't hear the Greens. You know, the Greens under Bob Brown back in the day used to be a small migration party. Now they don't care about this issue, and it's only people on the centre-right of politics who care about housing affordability, cost of living, environmental sustainability in our cities, and say that a moderate immigration policy is much more in Australia's interest than big Australia.
Yeah, it's true. All right, let's talk about a couple of international issues. The UN has cast a vote on Gaza. The United Nations Security Council is demanding an immediate ceasefire in the Gaza Strip and the release of all hostages. I'm glad that they included that because some of the other resolutions have not. The United States partially supported this because they abstained from the vote, which is one of the first times that they have done so. The remaining 14 council members voted in favour of the resolution, and there was a round of applause in the chamber after the vote today. Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, is upset. He's protesting. He's blamed the United States for allowing that to happen. I don't know where this is going, but I've never seen Israel surrounded by so many wagons right now.
Well, I just wonder, Chris, if post October 7, the relentless campaign against Israel and against the evidence of what actually happened with the terrorist attacks and the relentless campaign and protests in favour of Palestine has had an impact on the United Nations, where for the first time the Security Council has said, have a ceasefire. You know, you can say release the hostages, but why would Hamas release the hostages if there's a ceasefire? The ceasefire allows Hamas to go back to business of regrouping, rebuilding its terrorist networks, and replanning these terrorist attacks. So I'm very much on the side of Prime Minister Netanyahu here in saying the United States and the Biden administration there has yielded to the left-wing protests, all in favour of Palestine, against the evidence, and all against Israel, with the United States failing to veto at the Security Council this wretched resolution. The truth is there shouldn't be any ceasefire until Israel has the capacity to eliminate Hamas and the hostages are released. Then you can have a ceasefire. So what's happened at the UN and under Biden is out of sequence and against the interests and you'd say the fair interests of Israel.
And the sad part about this, and I keep thinking about something I don't read about, which are the hostages, the sad part about this, the longer this goes, Mark, we could get to the stage where only a handful of hostages are left alive when they're all eventually released.
Oh, absolutely. If there's a permanent ceasefire, you'll never see the hostages again. Hamas will regard them as further victims of terrorism. And Hamas must be encouraged by all these protests the other night at Port Botany, protests in the New South Wales Parliament last week when they interrupted proceedings in the lower house. All these Palestinian protesters and the anti-Semitism that's out there against Israel has had an impact globally. You know, this was forecast. A lot of people said, and they were right, that post-October 7, you watch the international sentiment shift. Instead of condemning the terrorism of Hamas and the barbarism of what happened on October 7, eventually there'll be an anti-Israel sentiment out there globally, and that's what we've seen at the United Nations.
Okay, let me raise a question that one particular viewer has commented on our chat box. Rob says, Israel is committing genocide against ordinary people, not Hamas. Let's keep on killing civilians in thousands. That makes sense, he says sarcastically. Now, even from what he says, Hamas are not committing genocide. Well, we forget about what happened on October 7 very conveniently. Having said that, gee, I tell you what, a lot of innocent people have died as well, though, Mark.
Well, Hamas started a war against Israel with those unprovoked attacks, terrorist attacks, you know, at that music festival, for example, and elsewhere on October 7. And Hamas, as a tactic, shelters in civilian venues like schools and hospitals. So if you start a war and then you go shelter in civilian facilities, then unfortunately in that war that you started, there will be civilian casualties. There's really no alternative for the Israeli armed forces. So I think all of this comes back to Hamas. You know, Hamas, if you start a war, at least be strong and courageous enough to fight that war in traditional military style instead of sheltering yourself in civilian venues like schools and hospitals and childcare centres, basically sacrificing the civilians around you as part of the war that you started. So I condemn Hamas at every turn here, and the person who sent that into you has lost all perspective on what's really going on here.
Okay, let me get to the other international story that the world will be glued onto in about, what will it be, about 8 hours from now. Julian Assange will be facing that High Court decision, which will be handed down tonight. That is morning London time, Tuesday morning. How do you think this is going to go? And what do you think is any form of justice out of this case?
Well, I fear he will be extradited to the United States, and he's another one we'll never see again. He'll be imprisoned there basically for the rest of his natural life. So unless the British High Court has a different perspective, according to international law, I think the tragedy here is that the Australian government hasn't intervened on behalf of an Australian citizen, Julian Assange, who you can say did wrong by leaking that information, but surely over the years, and there's many years now, he's suffered enough. He's lost his liberty. He's lost his health. And you would have thought the Australian government could say, bring him back to Australia, and we would do the necessary things under house arrest or, you know, those ankle bracelets to make sure that he doesn't infringe against international law in the future. But I personally think he's suffered enough. And to go to the United States now, basically he'll serve the rest of his life in an American prison. So we'll find out tonight his fate, but I fear it won't be the fairest and best interests of that Australian citizen.
Yeah, the law can be an ass, as we know, but it's almost as if justice in this case needs to be discretional, which is something that justice isn't normally like. But, you know, the discretion to basically say, hey, this is what you've done. You've self-imposed imprison in various forms. There has been a lack of liberty of life that you've experienced, and maybe what we need to do is come up with a deal. But I don't see any deal coming. And you mentioned Australia. We've sent certain representatives over, and a parliamentary task force, I think it was, representing all the various parties. But I think the prime ministers of both this particular government and the previous government didn't go hard enough to support him, did they?
No, I don't think Albanese's been very strong with Joe Biden. I mean, they had the White House dinner, and the bloke running rugby league seemed to have a higher profile than the interests of Julian Assange.
Yes.
So it was a bit of a carnival. But, you know, Assange basically leaked some security information he accessed. I suppose that's what journalists do. He published the material. That's what journalists do. And it related to American security interests, mainly about Afghanistan and Iraq. And you can be guaranteed, particularly those who started the Iraq war and all the military and civilian casualties, perhaps they've committed greater war crimes here than the journalist who was releasing the information to expose some of that.
That's not a bad point. That's not a bad point. I'll let you get back to your day job. Thank you so much for your time.
Okay, thanks, Chris. All the best.
Good on you, mate. Thank you. Mark Latham, Independent MP in the New South Wales Parliament, a member of the Legislative Council who we have on each and every Tuesday, and we thank him for giving us that time. And you may not necessarily agree with everything he says. That's what we're about here. We're not here to all nod furiously at each other. We're here to disagree and argue. So if you want to take him on, and you can do so on the open line, by all means, jump on. If you're calling from the United Kingdom, where the decision will be made in a few hours' time, 033-0024-1026, what will the High Court do in reference to Julian Assange, and what should they do? Is a deal one way in which justice can be seen to be done? If you want to call in from the United States or Canada, 1-888-201-6425, or from Australia and New Zealand, 1-800-670-310. This is Chris Smith on TNT.
Sometimes life can be overwhelming, and suicide may seem like the only way to relieve the pain. Beyond Now is an evidence-based app created by Beyond Blue to help you cope when suicidal thoughts start to appear. You can use it to create an easy-to-follow plan that is personal to you and includes steps like know your warning signs so you can act early, make your environment safe by removing harmful items, activities you can do or people you can be with to distract yourself from suicidal thoughts, reminders of things that make you feel strong. Some of these steps might be tough to fill out, and that's okay. It can be helpful to make or share your safety plan with a trusted friend, family member, or mental health professional. You might feel like you're alone, but help is available. If you're worried you can't stay safe, use the red telephone icon to call your emergency contacts. Download the free Beyond Now app today to create your personal safety plan.
Most people are unaware that bad bacteria can grow quickly in food that's stored, prepped, or cooked incorrectly, and that can lead to food poisoning. To avoid bad bacteria, always make sure your hands and cooking utensils are clean. Keep raw meat and chicken away from food that won't be cooked. Run your fridge at or below 5 degrees Celsius and use a meat thermometer to ensure your meat's being cooked to at least 75 degrees Celsius. For more tips on keeping bad bacteria at bay, visit foodsafety.asn.au.
The voice of a changing world, Chris Smith, on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Just on vaccine mandates, a little bit of feedback here from Scott, who sent me an email from Ulladulla on the south coast of New South Wales. He says, Kerry Chant, who's the chief health officer in New South Wales, Kerry Chant et al., they're not consulting anyone except lawyers over removing mandates. It was a point that I made yesterday because of the decision out of the Queensland Supreme Court, where it was proved to be illegal to stop police from doing their duty because they didn't have an updated vaccine regime. Well, maybe this is what has promoted New South Wales to think again, or they'll get their pantsuit off. Scott writes, the fact that no one in the mainstream media will talk about massive excess deaths globally or the huge spike in cancer in countries that mandated the jab because they were complicit, he argues. They published these jabs. Sorry, I think that should be published, these jabs, and they know it. So there you go. That's from Scott in Ulladulla. A couple of calls on our talkback lines. Let's go to Siv first up. Siv, thank you. Thank you for calling.
No worries. Just a quick word, if I may, on this whole thing about cashless societies. Look, I think as I always talk about whenever I'm here, we need to do the opposite of what we're being told. And I don't mean a, you know, sort of revolution, bloody revolutionary type way. I mean, when you're told, for instance, and this is the one I like to use, when you're told, for instance, that you need to go on some sort of plant-based diet, get the biggest piece of meat you can and go and have a fry up. You know, I mean, we've got to rebel. So these people want to tell us that we can't use cash and they want to send us to the digital age. Well, why don't you overwhelm the stores by using cash? Now, I know that it's made a little bit difficult by the banks closing off the ATMs and branches closing off everywhere. But where we can, you see, there is more of us than there is of them. We've got to remember that. There's more of us than there is of them. And if we just sit here and go, oh, geez, yeah, we're going to go into the cashless side. Oh, no, we're going to go into this bloody plant-based diet. And we just accept it. Well, they're going to keep doing it to us.
They
so
will.
So if we want to actually change something, we've got to fight for it.
Yeah, I think you're right. And we've seen that people power can work. You know, we resisted a carbon tax because people power played a role both in Canberra and on various places in the media. Bear in mind the media gave it a platform. But the problem with things like vaccine mandates, etc., mainstream media doesn't want to give it a platform because they don't know how to treat the subject. They don't know what's politically correct and they think it's politically incorrect to go into bat for those who were injured through vaccines. So it's a little bit skew-whiff on that score. But when it comes to, you know, climate change in particular and the way they want to change our life, you are dead right. We need to stand up. We need to protest. We need to contact our politician. We need to tell people, as many people as we can, that we're not going to put up with it.
Well, and we need to do the opposite of what they're telling us. That's the most important part of all of that. So if you hear these people banging on about digital, what's it, the cashless society and everything's going to be digital, then you need to get to your banks and you need to start withdrawing cash. Now, I'm not saying huge amounts, but when you do it en masse, these people take notice. And what politicians love and hate at the same time is numbers. We need to use that, and we need to use it to our advantage. Good to talk to you, Chris.
Good on you. It's a good rally call. Thank you so much, Siv. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Dan, who's on our talkback lines. Dan, go right ahead.
How you going, Chris?
Good, thank you.
You're talking about the vaccine injuries and you talked about Senator Rennick and he said there's maybe at least 5,000 deaths.
I can't remember the number. Let me get the number for you because it's an important number.
Sure.
He is saying, here it is. I've got it here right in front of me. He is saying that there were 10,000 these are excess deaths between May and December of 2021. And he's also saying that there are reports of 1,000 suspected deaths due to the vaccines in Australia. And yet the TGA only confirmed that there were 14.
Well, I was just having a look on the ABS, the Bureau of Statistics website just now, double checking. They've got 25,000 excess deaths from 2021, 2022, 2023.
That's true.
And I reckon that's close to the number that's been killed by the vaccine. It's a bit simplistic, but I think it's the most obvious solution. That's on their calculation, that's the minimum. You know, they've massaged the numbers a little bit to get there, Chris. And they've got 25,000. And
there is no doubt. Let me just add to that statistic. I think there's no doubt that during lockdowns and during COVID, when people didn't go to their appointments for their tumour or their, the pain they've got in their guts, which turns out to be cancer, that because of that, they've allowed their condition to worsen and that may have resulted in some deaths as well.
Yeah.
So we've got to be careful.
Yeah.
It's not a 100% contribution.
Exactly. That's right, but it's a rough number. It's not a bad one. It's a good guide to where we're at, and we've got if you go take the ABS's number at lowball number 25,000, anywhere up to 40,000. If you look at the total all cause mortality, you can get up to 40,000 excess deaths in those 3 years. Now, I just want to ask Chris.
But hang on, go back. Go back. Which category are you talking about, the 25,000? Is that excess deaths or is that deaths? Excess deaths. Yeah, okay.
Excess
all right, go
deaths,
ahead. Yep.
Right, above the... So
yep.
Because it's a statistical number, right? So they calculate it.
It's easy to calculate.
Yeah, and that's the ABS's own number. But they're saying some of it's COVID, but they can't attribute all of it to COVID. But I don't think any of it's attributed to COVID. I think all of it's the vaccine, more or less. And I just want to ask, Chris, at what point are these bureaucrats complicit to murder, you know? Are they, it's a conspiracy to cover up a mass murder of 40,000 Australians. If terrorists came here, Chris, in a boat or a plane or whatever, and killed 40,000 Australians, we'd be at war. But they were wearing business suits, and we've done nothing as a nation.
Yeah, it's a very good metaphor. That is a really good comparison. It's a situation where everyone is covering it up. You've got the TGA refusing to admit that these people have been injured, because if they compensate them, that's another statistic that needs to be added to the number of people who are injured, and they don't want to do that because the TGA played a significant role in putting jabs in arms, so they've got a conflict of interest. That's the cover-up. If that's not a story for mainstream media, I'm sorry, I haven't worked in it for 25 years, and I did.
It has to be the biggest story in the country still, Chris, until the day we sort it out.
I agree.
To be the only, it's the story. It's, even if it's 20,000, not 40,000, it's 20,000 Australians killed by these bastards. Mm. When are we going to do something about it?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, all we do is cover it up. We allow the Senate to know about it. But you see, the bureaucrats know that the mainstream media, you know, they've basically got the mainstream media around their little finger, because the mainstream media think it's politically incorrect to go down this path. Plus, it's too hard for them. They usually cut and paste, mate. Cut and paste is the way you do journalism in the modern era. It's not about, you know, getting and going chasing a real story and uncovering something that's not already printed. They don't do that. They're lazy. They're super lazy.
Yeah.
And that's why they don't cover what needs to be covered.
We need criminal charges for politicians and bureaucrats who committed this crime. And they need to be prosecuted. Thanks, Chris.
Appreciate that. Thank you very much for your call. I want to go to Glenn, who's also on the talkback lines. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, I agree with everything Dan said, but you said about the people that didn't go to their appointments for their cancers and stuff.
Yep.
That is true to a degree, Chris, but we also had Dr. Robert Malone, along with a avalanche of very well-qualified doctors, saying that the jab will destroy your immune system and bring cancers on, and those in remissions would would be fighting cancer all over again. So we were warned about all of this, but as you said, the media won't touch it, and I truly believe the media won't touch it, because they've got blood on their hands. They actually propagated all of this. They were the ones calling us granny killers and selfish bastards. And I remember that moron, John Laws, put out a call for medical people in the medical field to ring him, which they did, and then he demigrated them and called them liars. So I believe that the media should be charged with aiding and abetting this bloody homicide, which was propagated on this country by our politicians, who have sold us out to the one world government. Let's call it for what it is.
You're never accused of not telling it like it is. You just have, and I think that's a fair argument. I'd also add on to that, they actually knew right from the beginning that some of the treatments that they were belittling, like ivermectin, were actually decent drugs that could help people. But because they had all their eggs in the vaccine basket and Big Pharma was being placated, they ignored treatments, they belittled treatments, and that, to me, is a terrible act of bastardry.
Well, I agree with Dan. There should be criminal charges. And, mate, the media is a major player in all of this. They have been so bad. I had an argument with another moron that works on commercial talkback, and him and also John Laws, I argued that hard, I finally got him to admit they do no fact-checking whatsoever, and one of them, he's manager of that radio network, told me that he just follows the narrative because he doesn't want to get in trouble.
That wouldn't surprise me.
Spineless mongrels that we had pushing this thing. And don't forget, Chris, the New South Wales health surveillance data clearly showed The more jabs, the more likely to get sick and die. But nobody will take that up. I've been trying to argue that, and I get held down every time, but I continue to bring it out because their government statistics, which have been mirrored in countries all over the world, but yet...
They have. The same ratios have turned up everywhere.
Yes, and the mainstream media continue to cover it up because I believe they're just as guilty as the media was of the Nuremberg trials. I believe they should be hung.
Well, I don't know about hung, but can I just say this? Most media companies ran a line about vaccination, and I was part of that too, by the way. And I've spoken about that openly on here, and I got most of what I said wrong. And certainly that's been proved the case in research and studies that have been done since the pandemic. But I believed, you know, eminent immunologists that were telling me what they thought was the truth, and I got taken down the garden path. But that's not my point. My point is most of those media operators where their news arm said things that were positive for vaccination, they ran the community service agreements as well. They ran the ads to make sure that we took the jab.
That's right, mate. And don't forget, I told you about the great cow with Dr. Rimmel LeBeau.
Hey, listen, I've got to go. I'm right on news. I've got to go, Glenn. Thank you very much for calling. I appreciate that. We'll go to news right now. Back after that with plenty more, including Russell Broadbent.